were they really prioritizing security? Were they able to actually give this the level of seriousness that it really deserves?
Welcome to the Center for AI Policy podcast, where we zoom into the strategic landscape of AI and unpack its implications for U.S. policy. I'm your host, Jacob Krauss, and today's guest is Jeffrey Ladish. Jeffrey is Executive Director of Palisade Research, and we chat about cybersecurity, cyber offense, AI, and the connections between the three. I hope you enjoy. Jeffrey, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
To start, what drew you into the AI space? What motivated you to work on it?
Yeah, well, since college, I've been very interested in the impacts of technology on society, and in particular, maybe some question of like, oh, where is this all going? Like, what happens when you just keep playing for technological development? I was very interested in impacts of climate change and sort of, you know, the since the Industrial Revolution, all of the ways in which, oh yeah, we're like changing the planet in a big way. And then you have the invention of nuclear weapons, and suddenly you have the ability to destroy whole cities and maybe even cause large climate effects from nuclear war. And then I became interested in, you know, also, what about biotechnology? What about biological weapons? Wow, it seems like we have, you know, control over something that could be potentially very destructive. And then I think AI, I started reading about AI from, I found Eliezer Yudkowsky's work and Nick Bostrom's work. And the arguments made a lot of sense. I was like, oh yeah, at some point we'll develop systems smarter than humans. And that seems very risky because if they can think faster than us, if they can strategize better than us, if they can just do things generally better than us, it seems quite scary if they're not very well aligned with our interests. And I think for a while I was like, okay, but you know, who knows when that's going to be? That could be, you know, is that even possible? Maybe that'll be, you know, many, many decades. And you know, in the last few years, it seems like it's not going to be that long. It seems like things are really catching up and AI capabilities are extremely impressive. And you know, things that we thought would be many decades out have now been happening, you know, with increasing frequency. Yeah. So I, you know, right out of college, I worked in cybersecurity, worked for Concur Technologies, securing their software systems and infrastructure. And at the same time, I started to get into, some of this research on risks from emerging technologies. And this eventually led me to join the security team at Anthropic. I was the second person on the team. And basically was trying to figure out, oh, how do we secure AI systems, especially when there are potentially very motivated actors, including state actors, who might want to get a hold of some of these very powerful systems.
The piece about where is it all going sticks out to me because there's a lot of ways to look at what might happen in the future. And it's usually a good bet to say, well, in the past, look at this similar reference class, look at what other technologies did, or the first Industrial Revolution, what was that like? But there's always some amount of uncertainty where you don't know for sure what is going to happen, especially when you invent something that might be fundamentally different from previous
technologies. I think it's very different with intelligence. And I'd say, you know, look at, like, I spent some time in my undergrad studying biology, and I was researching monkeys. You know, and if you want to look at monkey evolution, you know, you can look at the other monkeys, right? You can be like, well, a capuchin monkey over here, a spider monkey over here, an orangutan over here. And you're like, well, you know, you can like look at these reference classes and be like, yeah, this is roughly how monkey evolution goes. And sure, there's going to be some differences. There's going to be long tails over here, maybe bigger body size, different diet, how much, you know, fruit versus meat or whatever. And then humans come along. And now we're talking about cities, skyscrapers, airplanes. And if you were looking at the reference class of monkey, which humans are monkeys, we're apes, then you really you're going to be misled. So I think even potentially looking at the Industrial Revolution, you might be looking at the wrong reference class, because the Industrial Revolution was, you know, this huge increase in human capacity. But it wasn't an increase in our intelligence overall. I mean, some of it was, you know, you have libraries, you have printing press, you have all of these, you know, information sort of technologies. But it wasn't sort of a fundamental new way of cognition. And now that we're heading towards that, I think the reference class is sort of blown wide open, and we have very little idea of how far it goes or what really happens. So yeah, in the context of this, I think being able to make these systems safe and secure them is quite important.
Right. And can you walk through what your work was at Anthropic on these topics?
Yeah, I mean, the basic work was, okay, you have a software company, fairly new. How do you make things secure such that bad actors can't get access to sensitive IP, so source code, model weights? I mean, there's something very unusual about AI companies in which their IP can be sort of more easily stolen and reused than almost any other technology. Even if you take something like, you know, like Google Docs or something, it's like, yeah, you could steal the source code, you could replicate Google Docs, that would be valuable. But there's a lot of infrastructure code that's involved in that, a lot of backend stuff, and like it's not sort of super easy to just immediately reuse that as like as a product. But there's something about, you know, a large language model where if you have all of the weights and you can just like run it on your own infrastructure, and suddenly you're able to just like use a super powerful system right out of the box. And then, you know, then compared to like hardware systems, like, you know, like a fighter jet or something, which we can talk about later. There's, you know, interesting example of when Chinese hackers were able to steal plans to the F-35, and they were able to, you know, sort of recreate many features of this fighter with sort of their own stealth fighter. But even then, there's a huge amount of work from that required to like take all of those insights and then turn that into something tangible. But with model weights, it is in that way, right? I can just have, you know, some model weights, and I can run them, and then now I have access to this super powerful AI system, almost as simple as copy paste. So, you know, I think there's a unique challenge here with securing AI companies, which is just the IP is just so readily reusable. But I mean, in terms of what you actually have to do to secure these systems, it's not really different than any other piece of software, right? You're just talking about a bunch of information. And so there's all of the standard things you need to do, right? There's like, do you have good physical security in your office? Are you vetting employees well? Are you protecting against insider threats? Do you have controls on who has access to really sensitive IP? Do you have really good device security? Are you making sure that no one's running malicious applications on their devices? Do you have phishing training and security awareness training? Really all the standard stuff. But yeah, and we can talk more later about sort of, does the standard stuff cut it, or do you have to go more hardcore? Spoilers, you have to go more hardcore. if your threat model is that state actors will be trying to go after your stuff. I mean, the key thing is, like, if you're trying to protect against opportunistic attackers, a lot of the standard stuff, multi-factor authentication, good device security, you know, code reviews and you know, good application security effort, these things can protect you quite a bit against opportunistic attackers. But once you have really motivated state actors that are deploying 0 days, you're in a very different ballpark.
Yeah. I think let's circle back to all that, but quickly finish the biographical part. What is happening now with Palisade Research?
Yeah, so last year I founded a nonprofit research organization, Palisade Research. And the thing we're trying to do is really understand what are the offensive capabilities that current systems possess. So, you know, how well can AI systems hack? You know, how well can they find zero-day vulnerabilities? How well can they automate different parts of the cyber kill chain? As well as how well can they deceive people? Can they fish people really effectively? Can they spear fish? Can they create, you know, compelling misinformation, you know, of the kind that might be able to swing elections? Can they accomplish tasks in the physical world? You know, could they assassinate someone? Could they, you know, and right now it's mostly like, could they be directed to do these things? But in the future, the question becomes, oh, could they do these things entirely on their own? So we're trying to research these capabilities because we think that the public and policymakers really should be aware of where we're at as well as where we're going, so that we have good models of like, hey, here's the threat, and that this is how we need to defend against it. This is how we need to sort of put in place responsible guardrails, both in the systems themselves and in society and in sort of the regulatory side of things, in order to protect against some of the dangers that these systems pose.
Right. And where are we at now? What's possible with, I think phishing is possible with AI systems today, like ChatGPT. What is the current state of the art in cyber attacks?
Yeah, Jacob, the fun thing is that we don't know. Like, we don't know where we're at right now. And I think this is a thing that not a lot of people appreciate. Which is to say, you know, probably the most powerful model right now, though, you know, with Gemini, it's hard to say, is GPT-4 or was GPT-4 until very recently. And, you know, this model has been out for a year or so. And you might be like, cool, well, GPT-4 comes out, you know, spin it up, see what it can do, see if, you know, have it hack some stuff, and then you'll know what it can do, right? But it turns out that that's actually not right, because it's actually pretty difficult to elicit the full capabilities from a system like this. So you can do like chain of thought prompting, where you're like, hey, please, you know, think step by step, right? Like let's like reason through this first, and then try to do it, and then that improves the model's performance. You can also say, think step by step, and also try this thing, and then observe what happens. So OpenAI has a code interpreter if you're on ChatGPT, and like if you've used this before, you see that it's like, oh, it, you know, it writes some code, it runs the code, and then it looks at the output from the code, and then it sees like, what did that work? Did that not work? And then it can run it again, and it can sort of stay in the loop and do this a bunch. And there's many other techniques like this that you can use to like elicit more and more capabilities. So, you know, the thing we can talk about right now is, okay, what have people managed to elicit from these systems? But the thing I want to emphasize is that that doesn't actually tell us like what is possible with these models. It just tells us what has been possible so far with some amount of effort. So, I mean, so far we've seen pretty interesting results. Yeah, in phishing for sure. So like Palisade is working on a like phishing tool that basically can sort of scrape the internet and like find information about a target. Maybe it's a target company, you know, lists all of the employees, lists the employees' interests and skill sets, and maybe their relationships. And then we can craft custom spear phishing emails for those people. We've also seen there's an interesting paper that just came out that was like, you know, AI systems can like hack websites pretty well. And they were able to find SQL injections and like a bunch of different kinds of like standard web exploits to be able to hack websites. So, you know, I'd say what we're seeing is like we're seeing a lot of like pretty basic capabilities, but like pretty scalable capabilities when it comes to the cyber offensive domain. We are yet seeing capabilities of like, oh, you like can plan this whole cyber campaign. You know, you can do each step. You can sort of iterate on that. Like language models are still, you know, even with sort of help from programmatic scaffolding and prompting techniques, they're still pretty bad at staying on task and being able to iterate a whole bunch of times. So for these like quick problems, like, you know, create some code to sort of try to exploit this thing, they can do pretty well. But if they have to deal with a huge amount of information, or if they have to like deal with a longer time horizon task, they're going to be way worse at that. So, you know, these are some proofs of concepts. These are some like early capabilities. But, you know, we don't know. We don't know where it's going to go. Like this is really just the beginning, both in terms of, you know, what you can elicit from current models and, you know, the next models are only going to get better at this. So, yeah, it's quite interesting.
The part that stands out is how a nation state actor with loads of resources might be able to execute a really devastating attack, even on something that has a lot of resources spent on defense. And I imagine AI can play some role in this today already through some of the pathways that you were pointing out. But what are some, what examples come to mind when you think of a really carefully thought out state actor attacks? And can you flesh out the details of what those actually look like? What are these people doing?
Yeah. Lots of great examples here. I mean, almost too many examples. Like we could spend all day talking about examples of this. I think a couple that come to mind, one is one I alluded to earlier, which was the theft of designs and engineering material for the F-35. State actors, probably Chinese state actors, were able to compromise sort of a bunch of companies, defense contractors that were involved in this thing. I mean, with a project as complex as the F-35, you just have a huge amount of people and a lot of different organizations all working on it. And that means you can sort of go after some of the lower hanging fruit. So you don't necessarily have to compromise the most secure of these companies. You just have to compromise, you know, the least secure of these companies, and then use their access to gain access to information that's highly sensitive. And so the Chinese state actors were totally able to do this. This like IP alone cost like, you know, more than $50 billion, probably a lot more. And they were able to replicate a bunch of the sort of features of the F-35 in their own fighter. That's one of my favorite examples. The reason why I think this one is so important is it's just like, you know, the F-35 is obviously a super important, strategically relevant aircraft, right? So it's like something that the US government really would prefer, you know, potential rivals to really not have access to. You have a lot of incentives to secure that. It's not like people weren't trying to secure this information, but it's really hard. Another great example is in 2015, again, Chinese state actors were able to steal like 22 million records from the Office of Personnel Management. And this is basically like information. So this is like the SF-86 form. If you apply for a clearance from the government, that basically it includes like a lot of information about, you know, what relationships do you have, romantic relationships, or like, do you have any foreign contacts? Have you associated with anyone from foreign countries? Do you have any debts? Do you owe someone significant amounts of money? Do people have leverage over you? You know, because you want to see if these people might present a security risk before you give them clearance and access to sensitive information. But unfortunately, that's like exactly what an adversary might want, because they might want to know is there leverage over these people? You know, who are they associating with? How could they potentially be reached? And so this entire database was stolen, including like, you know, 5 million sets of fingerprints. And, you know, this was a huge own, like a huge L, right? Like this is really embarrassing. And one of the interesting things that came out of this was that the CIA used a different database. So the CIA records were not affected, which is great, right? You know, you wouldn't want CIA officers compromised. However, one of the things the CIA often does is it implants agents within the State Department, and they, you know, pose as diplomats, and they, you know, sort of have all of the access and immunity that diplomats get. But now, you know, if you're a Chinese state actor and you have access to this OPM database, and you notice some State Department officials who really should have clearances but don't seem to show up in this database, well, they're probably CIA. So the U.S. actually had to withdraw a whole bunch of CIA agents from China, and I imagine from other countries as a result of this breach. So again, strong incentive to protect this information. This is very strategically relevant information, very bad for an adversary to have, but we were unable to secure it.
And is that a function of someone did a bad job, or is it more the case that even no matter how hard you try, there's always going to be a vulnerability? What is the theoretical limits of defense?
Yeah, this is a good question. I think sometimes I present some of these examples and people throw up their hands and they're like, why should we even try? Like, you know, clearly, you know, a sufficiently motivated attacker can basically steal anything. And I think that this is like partially true and importantly not true. The way in which it's partially true is that like modern systems are very complex. There's just many, many different pieces, you know, and if we're talking about a system that's used by a lot of people, there's going to be a lot of attack surface. However, like in order for like a state actor to really gain access to some of these systems, especially systems that have been hardened, they often have to use very expensive techniques. They have to develop zero-day vulnerabilities, vulnerabilities that have never been found before. And these often take millions of dollars to develop. And then, you know, if they use them, there's a chance those vulnerabilities will be detected and then patched. And then they can't reuse them. So it's like, you know, state actors can, with pretty high confidence, compromise most targets. But they have to be very picky and choosy about which targets they're really able to compromise. And what you can do is you can greatly increase the cost to attackers, such that, you know, they're able to get far less than they would otherwise. And if your thing is important enough, like it is possible to secure against even the most capable adversaries, but you have to be willing to incur significant costs, both in terms of sort of the usability of whatever you're doing, and in terms of just like the personnel hours and sort of all of the things that you need to do to like really lock things down. Like it's doable, sort of. It's not theoretically impossible. It's just like very difficult in practice. And often it comes down to incentives. Like, are people incentivized to actually protect this stuff? You know, whoever was like in charge of, you know, the Office of Personnel Management, were they really prioritizing security? Were they able to actually give this the level of seriousness that it really deserves? And this is like what we often see in the private world, right? Which is, you know, companies only have some incentive to secure their systems. And it's like, you know, a company can often survive, or they usually just do survive hacks, right? It looks bad, right? You know, maybe they take some revenue hit, but it doesn't fundamentally compromise their business. And so, whereas, you know, if they fail to deliver, if they fail to ship products, maybe that does fundamentally compromise their business. So they're going to be more focused on being able to ship products, you know, being able to build stuff, than they are on securing their own systems. And this creates this negative externality where, yep, a lot of our information just gets stolen. I think it's doable, but it's just, it can be very challenging, especially if you need to protect against some of the most advanced adversaries.
Right. And what kinds of incentives are we talking about in the context of AI models? I think I heard Anthropic CEO talking about, we aim to make it so that the investment needed to gain access to our IP is higher than the value of that IP. And they said, we're not there yet, but we're trying to get there. What is so valuable to steal within the development of an AI model? What might be a target?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the sort of most obvious target is the model weights themselves. Because if you have the model weights, then you really can run, you know, millions of copies of it. You can also do additional fine-tuning, additional training. And that also means removing any potential guardrails that the system might have. So, you know, let's say that Anthropic developed some really powerful language model, but it was, you know, fine-tuned or had other controls in place so that it was hard to use, you know, for cyber offensive capabilities. In that case, a state actor might be like, well, we want those cyber offensive capabilities. Cool. We steal the model weights and then we just fine-tune it a little bit to be able to, you know, to be super happy to, you know, generate exploits or whatever. And at Palisade, we've shown that it takes very little to sort of like remove guardrails in this way. If the guardrails are just have been trained in, you can just train them out. Like we took Llama 2, which took a few million dollars to train, and for a few hundred dollars, we were able to just like very quickly remove those safeguards and then get the model to sort of help us with arbitrary things that it had been previously trained not to do. Model weights are one thing. I think, you know, source code is another thing. Sort of all of the little like finicky insights that you develop in the course of training a very complex system like this can be quite valuable. I mean, there's just so many things that AI labs know that other people don't know in terms of like how to make a very powerful and very useful AI system. So it's quite valuable to be able to access that. And I mean, I think that like, you know, the thing that Dario, the CEO of Anthropic, said makes a lot of sense, right? Which is, you know, well, okay, we know that like other actors can train models this big. So let's just make it more expensive for them to steal our models than for them to train their own. I think that makes sense right now. I think, you know, in the future and maybe even the near future, we'll be getting to the point where, you know, we're training models that have the capability to cause a huge amount of harm in society. That could be catastrophic. And I think at that point, we really want to secure both, you know, the hardware side so that other people can't train models that can cause a giant catastrophe. And the software side, so that people can't, you know, gain access to that. You know, even if they don't have access to the hardware themselves, they can't just like grab another model, and then be able to walk out with it and potentially misuse it to serious effect.
Yeah, importantly, the cost for someone, the amount that someone could gain from hacking the Anthropic model weights, does not necessarily include the costs to society if you use those to cause significant harm. So I can see some externalities there, even in a, like an analysis where it's based on let's make it infeasible for the actor to gain it. So what is the current state at frontier AI developers like OpenAI in their cybersecurity, and what remains to be done to make it sufficiently strong?
Yeah, so I would direct people's attention to a recent RAND report. It's sort of an interim report on securing model weights. So if you Google like securing model weights RAND report, this will come up. And one of the things they do in this report, you know, the full report is going to come out, you know, in the next few months. But one of the things that they outline here are sort of like, well, can we sort of say, you know, what it would take to secure against different threat models, against different threat actors? And they have a concept of security level. So like security level one is, you know, it's sort of the standard security most companies have. Security level two, you can protect against some opportunistic attackers. Security level three is like you can defend against most non-state actors, right? Like if you're talking like Lapsus Group, which hacked NVIDIA last year, if you're talking about, you know, sort of fairly capable, like, you know, organized groups, but that are not yet at the state level yet, you can protect against most of them. Security level four is you can protect against a lot of state actors, probably maybe not the top ones if they prioritize you, but you're doing, you know, this is sort of an extraordinary level of security. And then security level five is you can protect against even the top state actors, even if they prioritize you. Which, by the way, I think is the threat model we have to take very seriously going forward, because I think I would guess that the AI companies are sort of now being prioritized as, you know, probably near the top of target lists for some of these countries. And my sense, you know, from talking to people at AI companies and, you know, just my own views as well, is that we're probably somewhere between security level two and security level three for most of these companies. Some are probably closer to 3. Some are probably closer to 2. This is a bit concerning, right? Because it means that, you know, even some capable non-state actor groups could probably compromise them, and a lot of state actor groups almost certainly could. And it seems likely that, like, some of these companies can get to, you know, security level 3 pretty soon if they throw resources at it. And I know a lot of them really are. So I feel pretty confident that, you know, 3 is achievable pretty soon. And I think it's really great that a lot of companies are working really hard on this. But to get to 5, you know, even to get to 4, it's going to take a huge amount of resources, and it's going to take a lot of effort, and it's going to take prioritization. So I would say, you know, we're like headed in the right direction, but I'm very concerned that we're not really on track in terms of getting there in the relevant timescales.
How can we get there in the relevant timescales? What needs to happen?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we can break this out a little bit into sort of like, well, what's the technical problem? And then sort of what's the incentive or institutional problem? Mm-hmm. In terms of the technical problem, I mean, hey, one of the nice things about this problem is that, like, we don't have to invent any new forms of science to solve it. That's a bit of a joke, because I think, you know, when it comes to aligning AI systems or making them very safe, the field is wide open. Like, we have so little idea how these systems actually work that figuring out how to make them robustly safe really doesn't require sort of inventing a whole new field of science. But security is not like that. Like, we've been figuring out how to secure systems for decades, and people have made a lot of progress. People have made progress on the hardware side, on the software side, on the sort of the physical security side. So there's a lot of sort of known things that we can apply here. And, you know, it'll take some like novel R&D as well. I think like the RAND report mentions that we need more development on hardware security modules, you know, sort of specialized hardware for being able to secure model weights and other sort of crucial pieces of this like software and hardware supply chain. And so, you know, I think it's going to take a lot of skilled people. I think people with experience defending against state actors, you know, both on the private side, like at Google and Microsoft. So I think we really want our best people from industry to be working on this. And I think we also need some of our best people in government to be working on this, right? Like, people who have experience on the offensive side, who actually know what are the tools that the best state actors are capable of doing. I think, you know, we need a lot of resources. We need a lot of people. I think these problems are tractable, but difficult. Unfortunately, I worry that the incentives are just not there. I think that, like, you know, AI companies don't want to be hacked, right? Like, they definitely have an incentive. Like, you know, this is very valuable IP. It's not like that they want some country to walk away with it and, you know, be able to, you know, make a clone AI company or anything like that. But if the cost of securing these things, you know, starts taking up a significant chunk of the overall operating expenses or R&D budget of the companies, which I think is very plausible for the level of security we're talking about, now you start to be at a pretty big competitive disadvantage if you start spending 10, 20, 30% of your overall budget on security or on figuring out the security R&D to make all this stuff work. And you know, you're requiring your like employees to go work in an environment that's much more locked down, or they can't bring in their phone. And like, it's very culturally different as well. So I don't see another way other than having this be, you know, not optional, like not something that as a company you can be like, YOLO, whatever, like we're gonna make more money if we just like go ahead and we don't try to lock this down. Like, I think it starts to become an issue of national security as well as an issue of, you know, security more broadly in society, right? Like, I think, you know, the failure modes here are potentially very catastrophic. And, you know, I don't think we want to just trust that like the normal corporate incentives will be sufficient to get to the level of security that we need. So, you know, I think that, you know, at some level, it's like, hey, if you're getting to AI systems that really have some of these capabilities we're most concerned with, I think the government needs to step in and say, one, you're not allowed to develop past this unless you can prove that you have this level of security. You know, and two, I think the government needs to itself invest a lot of resources in actually doing some of this R&D and in providing some of the expertise, you know, maybe providing physical security. And I don't know exactly what this looks like, right? I think we're in pretty uncharted waters here. But it seems like some kind of public-private partnership could be very important, right? Like, it seems like we need people who really do know what it's like to say, like, you know, we sent in spies into your organization and we're able to, you know, extract your critical information, which is a thing that's illegal to do unless you're the government. So, you know, I think the only people who really have that expertise are people who you know, have seriously worked on the offensive side, you know, within the NSA or within the FBI, right? Like, we need these kind of people.
On the public-private partnerships, I'm confused why it wouldn't be enough to simply set mandatory cybersecurity requirements for companies and then let the companies hire top talent. Is there simply a scarcity of cybersecurity talent and that's why we need to bring in partnerships, or does the government have some of the best expertise anywhere? Why do we need to bring them in?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little of both. So there is scarcity. I think like it is, it's just, in fact, very hard to hire for some of these roles. But I think that like talent is sort of unevenly distributed. So I think some of the best offensive security skills sit within various parts of DoD or the intelligence world.
Okay.
Whereas I think like a lot of some of the best like defensive skills, security engineering skills are at like, you know, Google and Microsoft and Apple and some of these other companies, right? Because they've been building these systems at scale, securing them at scale. So some of it is like getting top talent. But some of it comes down to trust and like verification, right? Which is to say, okay, like let's say I put in, you know, I have regulations for all of these requirements. Do I actually trust that companies have implemented them well? Like, how do I check? Like, I think that we do have some models here, right? We can look at like, well, what do defense contractors have to do? Often you have to get clearances in order to work on, you know, projects for the government. And so you could definitely have a model like that for models that have like huge national security implications. But there is this question of like, oh, do you like, would you want companies to like directly handle nuclear weapons or like directly handle biological weapons? Like you start to have to ask like, okay, like how are they vetting their employees? Like is security clearances enough? Like, is this actually sufficient? So, you know, I'm arguing that we need something that's sufficient and I don't know exactly what that would be. Maybe you can do it just entirely by like having, you know, really strong security recommendations that you, you know, audit and enforce. But I worry a little bit.
And you were saying that luckily, unlike with AI alignment, we have a lot of decades to look back on of research on cybersecurity. We know some really good practices, but are there areas of novel research to be done? One I've heard of is it would be great if we could put in a feature on AI chips that lets you tell roughly where it is so that we can see if it's being smuggled to China, for instance, and to do this and have it be resistant to someone breaking it, tampering with it, or even better, have it be fully guarded against that seems to require, I've heard, between 18 months to 5 years of new R&D that isn't currently being done. Are there other areas of cybersecurity that require new research?
Yeah, I think there are. I mean, I think that's a good example. And I think there's lots of other things related to the, like the chip side that would be very valuable to do. So like, you know, tamper proofing, tamper detection. Like you said, chip tracking. I also think that we need to think about sort of how do we operate systems at scale in a way that's very secure. Like when you have like a whole bunch of data centers and you start to have like this larger attack surface and you're dealing with like, you know, many, many gigabytes of data or terabytes of data. How do you actually run infrastructure like that at scale in a way that's as secure as we need it to be? Like in some ways, this is a pretty unique challenge. I don't think there's ever been like a product where you're like, hey, I want to like serve this to a billion users or 5 billion users. But also we want it to be so secure that even top level state actors don't have access to it. I'm like, oh geez, can you choose one of these? Like choosing two of these is like not very good. And I mean, part of the answer here is I'm like, yeah, you don't serve your like AI systems with catastrophic capabilities to a billion people. Like you just don't. Maybe you do in the future when you figured out a bunch of stuff that we haven't figured out yet. But I think, you know, there comes some point where you're like, oh, this system is like so critical that we need to like operate it out of a much more secure environment. So yeah, I don't think I have a whole like security roadmap in terms of like the technical R&D that needs to be done. But I know a bunch of people who are working on that. And, you know, I'm excited to see what they come up with in terms of like, yeah, what are some of these R&D questions? Because I think we need that roadmap, right? We need to figure out, yeah, what are the actual problems we need to solve here in order to make this work?
And to dig into the catastrophic capabilities, OpenAI put out a preparedness framework for catastrophic risk, and they put out different levels of risk on capabilities in the cyber domain. So some at the most critical level are systems that could identify functional zero-day exploits across all software projects without human intervention. I'm paraphrasing from them,
yeah,
or devise end-to-end novel strategies for cyber attacks against hardened targets, given only a high-level desired goal. So yeah, let's say we had that level of capability. What would you be worried about that system being able to do, whether it's gone autonomously doing that or whether a malicious actor is telling it to do that?
Yeah, so I think in order to understand the impact of this, we have to zoom out a little bit and understand what's the state of cybersecurity more generally. And like, and as well as this question we talked about earlier of like, what are the capability of state actors and where are their limitations? So like, I think it's actually pretty interesting because overall, I would say, you know, the internet and devices have gotten a lot more secure in the last couple decades. Like, I don't know if you remember like early Windows computers where they're just, you just like, get viruses all the time. There'd be like weird pop-ups and stuff. And you'd be like, not again. and like, you know, hopefully that doesn't happen to you anymore or happens very rarely. Right. And that's because people have designed operating systems to be more secure. And they like now have much better processes, especially the big software manufacturers or developers are able to write more secure code and do a lot more testing. And, you know, at the same time, state level capabilities have kept up in a significant way. You know, with enough time and effort, you can take almost any piece of software and find a vulnerability in it if you invest, if you're smart enough and invest enough resources. But it's very expensive, right? So, you know, investing enough resources is kind of key here. So even though state actors can compromise almost any target, they can't compromise every target because it would be far too expensive. So they have to prioritize and choose. But if you have like an, you know, limitless faucet of zero-day vulnerabilities, if you have an AI system that can just like find software in anything, that limitation goes away, right? And now you're like, no, you can hack any device, right? Because you just pull up like, what's the software running on this device? And then you say, all right, you know, system, you know, zero-day system, like go find the zero-days. It finds them, you develop some exploits for you. And, you know, now you've compromised, you know, whatever you want. So, you know, I mean, we could talk about, well, what does that mean? I mean, it means you can compromise, you know, most cars, most hospitals, most, you know, any part of government, any company, you know, and there's this question about offense defense balance, right? Which is like, oh, well, maybe if attackers have this, maybe defenders also have this. And it becomes this like cat and mouse game, which is like, can you patch vulnerabilities, you know, faster than attackers can exploit them? But this is tricky, right? Because attackers like only have to find one or, you know, a couple in order to gain access, whereas like you need to patch all of them. And so even if you know where they all are, you're finding them a lot, like it takes work to do that patching, you know, and maybe you could automate parts of that for, you know, for sure. Like that's true. You can do some of that. But often there'll be a lot of limitations in terms of just the speed that you're able to do that. And it also really depends on like what your, you know, capacity as an organization is, right? Like this is sort of already a big problem. When I first entered the security industry, one of the things that my team did was, you know, run vulnerability scanners across our environment. These are like commercial products made by security companies, you know, and it just finding existing vulnerabilities that we already know about. And so we'd find hundreds or thousands of them across, you know, because it's like you're talking about a lot of computers, right? You're talking about a lot of machines. And then we'd prioritize them and then we'd patch them. But it was slow and it took a long time. And, you know, and so it's like, how much resources are you putting into that? And so, yeah, I mean, I think that like with the automated zero-day thing, you start to get into a pretty crazy world. And then, you know, the sort of end-to-end cyber kill chain automation, which is, I think, what that's kind of pointing at. Now you can, you know, any script kiddie basically can like go and point, you know, point the system at a target and has a decent chance of being able to compromise that target. And so that greatly increases the number of threat actors who can compromise stuff. So I think with that, you'd see a huge increase in malware. You'd see a huge increase in, you know, ransomware and just like, you know, a lot more like cybercrime as well. And, you know, and state actors would be able to scale their attacks as well. Yeah, it'd be in both cases, I think, a little wild.
Can you step back to more general perspective here and tell people about the security mindset?
Yeah. So, and the security mindset, a lot of people have talked about this. I think Bruce Schneier has his great blog, and he's discussed this in a few essays. But it's basically like thinking, it's like, you know, how do you think like an attacker? Like, how do you, when you see a system, are you thinking about like, what are the ways that this system like performs well? Or are you thinking about like, wait, can I find vulnerabilities in this system? I think a lot of times when I'm looking at an AI system, you know, someone's like, hey, we made this cool ability to like clone voices. And they're like, oh, yeah, great. We'll be able to like make funny music. You know, you can like, you know, be like, you can have Obama singing a Taylor Swift song or whatever. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you can fish people, right? Like you can impersonate, you know, you could impersonate someone's parent or you can impersonate someone's colleague and like get them to send you money. Right. Like, you know, OpenAI releases this like, you know, a video image generation and you're like, oh, cool. I can like, you know, make a cool dance video or I can like make a cool video of a boat, you know, and then I'm like, oh, I can like, you know, show, you know, some secret political deal and like live action from the White House and this deal goes down or whatever. You know, I don't know exactly what the right thing is. Or like, you know, impersonate someone's death, right? You could like get a video of someone being assassinated and then put this on social media and people are like, oh my God, the Brazilian president got assassinated and we have this video of it, but it's fake, right? So I think it's like really trying to put yourself in the mindset of an attacker and think about like, you know, all of the ways that the system could be misused, you know, either by finding like actual exploits in the system, but also just figuring out, you know, ways at which, you know, people didn't think about this. Another example, one of the things that we're doing at Palisade is testing phishing, right? We're testing like how well can AI systems phish people. And so we're like developing a sign up form so that people can sign up to be a sort of testing population. You know, we're not going to like actually steal your information, but we'll see if you'll click a link. We'll see if you're, you know, like enter something that you probably shouldn't, and then let you know that you've been phished, and you know, get some data at the same time about how successful these attacks are. You know, and we're like, hey, we want to make sure that people consent to do this. We don't want to deceive people who haven't consented. So you know, a naive person might be like, great, well, we'll put up a form, we'll have a checkbox that says, do I consent, and then input your email, and then there you go, right? Now, you know, now we have all this list of emails and we can phish people. And then like, if you're an attacker, you might be like, okay, but couldn't I put in Jacob's email and say, I consent? Like, how do they know it's Jacob? And I'm like, oh yeah, you probably want to put in email verification because otherwise people will totally sign up their friends who did not at all consent to be deceived or phished here. So it's like that kind of thing, right? It's just like, are you thinking about, you know, how an attacker would work? And I think what's challenging here is that for a lot of people, this is a very unnatural mindset. Even extremely smart, extremely technical people, right? So I think a lot of people developing AI systems are very smart. They're not dumb. Like they can totally follow along to any, you know, technical conversation. They can understand how, you know, zero-day vulnerabilities work. But when they're building a system, they're thinking about how it can be functional and work and help people. They're not thinking about, oh, how could this be misused or how could this be compromised or how could this be, you know, made more vulnerable. So I think as a result, you know, for better or for worse, people end up having these big blind spots that sort of keep them from seeing, you know, ways that things could go wrong, both in terms of like, you know, cybersecurity, but also in terms of like, is your AI system aligned? Like, is your AI system going to do things that you really didn't want it to do? So yeah, that's my summary.
Very nice. And before we wrap up, was there anything else you wanted to share with listeners?
I think it's like going to be quite important that people start thinking about like ways in which society is just very likely to change as a result of these technologies. Like, you know, we've been talking a lot about like the macro implications and like, oh, how might this impact policy or how might this impact sort of like what the companies should do? But I think like what's likely to happen for a lot of individuals is just that like a lot of people are going to try to scam them, are going to try to hack them, are going to try to like deceive them using AI systems. You know, I think people need to start being more skeptical about voice calls or video calls. Like just because you get a voice call from someone doesn't mean that the voice that you hear is actually the voice that you think you're hearing. And same with the video call. Like this is going to happen, I think, pretty quickly. And I think it's going to catch a lot of people off guard. And so I do think there's a component of like trying to educate people and trying to be like, hey, you know, you can defend yourself by like being aware of what capabilities exist and starting to think about like, oh, yeah, how do I check? Like, this was weird. Like, you know, just like slightly increase your spidey sense for things that, you know, you didn't have to pay attention to a few years ago. But, you know, increasingly so is going to be important to take note of.
Great. And where can listeners go if they want to learn more about these topics or your work?
Yeah, so yeah, they can go to palisaderesearch.org. And that's where we'll be posting our work and updates and that kind of thing.
Great. Thanks, Jeffrey, so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Jacob. Great being here.
Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Center for AI Policy podcast Substack for a transcript, links, and more.
And you can reach me with any feedback at jakub@aipolicy.us. Looking ahead, next episode will feature Jason Greenlow discussing the role of legal liability in keeping AI safe. I hope to see you there.